Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Cult I Left Behind podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Briggs, and I'm here to tell you my stories of growing up in the IBLP cult, which you might know from the Duggar family.
And I'm your other host, Kyle Briggs. I am Amanda's husband, and I have not heard most of these stories before, so stay tuned and we'll all get traumatized together. All right, welcome back to the next episode. We are going to continue the theme with another listener-inspired episode. We've got lots of questions and comments and messages from listeners. They grew up in similar situations to Amanda, whether that's in the cult or whether that was...
Or another cult.
Or another cult, or in just, sexually abusive environments.
Mm-hmm. And again, I know we talked about this in the past, but we do read all of these messages, and we're very honored that you share your story. And something I've gotten a lot of questions about is healing specifically as an adult around the sexual assault. So I've had people ask me, are you still triggered by it? Do you still struggle with this in your marriage? Is it impacting you? And so we wanted to take some time to talk about this, because one of the problems with cults is if you grow up in a cult or a repressive environment, no one's telling you these things. No one's talking to you about sex and healing and how to have a healthy sexual relationship and what to do in your marriage if you've experienced sexual assault. So I feel like the energy I want for this episode is like the big sister I didn't have to help me grapple with these things. And I won't say I'm a reigning expert on human sexuality and relationships, and there are some other people who have podcasts, who've written books, who do talks that are far more qualified to speak to that. But what I can speak to is healing to a point where you no longer have triggers and are able to have a healthy sexual relationship as an adult. So, in an ongoing effort to break down barriers created by cults, this is a little bit, Kyle, would you say this is a little bit of a deviation from what we normally talk about on the podcast?
Yeah, I mean, it's related, though.
It's like adjacent.
Yes, thank you. I was trying to find the word.
Adjacent.
It was. It's adjacent to the cult, just because the sexual abuse and rape and harassment.
And then you put like purity culture, which we still need to talk about.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of our listeners grew up in purity culture and, are still grappling with that. And
so since there's so many sex related things with the cult.
Yeah.
I think it's relevant.
Okay. Well, gosh, I don't even know where to start, because I didn't really go through that portion of my life with you. I was married to my ex-husband, which I've blocked a lot of those memories. But I can tell you, a couple things that I do remember. So we've talked about this on the podcast before. I, other than, being raped, did not have sex until marriage because I was a good Christian cult person. And it was, well, I'll just say this. My ex and I were young when we got married. We were 22 and 20. And as far as I know, it was both of our first time having, consensual sex, the consensual being on my part. As far as I know, my ex did not have any sexual assault. And I'm pretty confident in that statement. And I don't know. Is anyone good at sex their first time?
I don't think so. That's a pretty socially accepted thing, that the first time is always bad.
Yeah, so that wasn't great. And we were on our honeymoon, obviously, because good Christian kids, we waited. And the first thing I want to talk about is what it is like to become consensually sexually active and still be in some proximity to the person who sexually assaulted you. So my ex and I went to another state for our honeymoon, and then we came back home and we were in the same town as the rapist brother. And what was fine on our honeymoon, suddenly I was curled up in a ball crying. And I still don't fully know why, but all I could think about when we got back to our apartment was that my brother only lived a couple miles away. And it really messed with my brain. And I was unable to have sex for, I think it was only a couple days after we got back. But that didn't go over real well. And but it was very real for me. It was very real that, oh man, being so geographically close to the person who had sexually violated me while trying to have like happy, normal, consensual marriage sex, it didn't work out real well for me initially. Unfortunately for me, what I did was I like just pushed myself through that and made myself pretend I was okay. We moved to a different city, still in the same state, still not super far away from my brother, but like half an hour away, maybe 40 minutes away, a couple months after we got married, and I did significantly better there. And I will say that probably one of the ways my past impacted me, because I hadn't gone through treatment for PTSD yet. I hadn't been diagnosed yet.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd been in group therapy, and then I'd gone to the Christian therapist Rick and Chris said I could go to. Mm-hmm. And we weren't doing sex positive therapy there. But I'd read a book because no one ever gave me the sex talk. So I'd read a book when we were engaged, my ex and I read a book together that was very religious. I think it told us we should get on our knees by the bed and pray before consummating our marriage. I don't think we did that.
I was going to ask.
I don't remember, honestly.
I was going to ask if the book was helpful, but I'm going to say no.
It was helpful in that it provided illustrations and like anatomy lessons that I never had.
Yeah.
And that I was too, you know, scared/righteous to Google. So somehow the drawing in the book was more righteous than a drawing on Google. I'd read the book. But one of the ways I would say the sexual assault impacted me when I got married and became sexually active was that I was very accustomed to just doing what I was expected to do. I'm trying to think of the right way to word that, not like the purity culture way to word it, but an accurate way to word it. Because I think the other thing was, you know, we talked about this in the Shiny Happy People review, how the Duggar girls were told, like, always be sexually available to your husband. Mm-hmm. I had the same subtle messaging my whole life. Again, Chris never gave me the sex talk. No one ever gave me the sex talk, but I wasn't dumb. And you kind of put two and two together growing up in the IBLP cult, and you realize like, oh, okay, that's how babies are made. And also there are a lot of babies, so there must be a lot of this going on. Mm-hmm. And that's probably what's expected of me as a woman. And what I want, what I need, you know, whatever doesn't matter. And so I would say sex was incredibly one-sided. You can read into that all you want and you will probably be correct. And I wouldn't say it was a happy or fulfilling part of my previous marriage or that time of my life. It wasn't super traumatic. It was a little traumatic, but it wasn't super traumatic. And honestly, I would say I was more healed because I'd at least address the fact that sex was an issue because I'd been through some therapy at that point for sexual assault. I think anyone, male or female, who goes into a relationship where you haven't been allowed to even consider the fact that you're a sexual being your whole life until you say I do at the altar and the pastor says, man and wife, you can kiss the bride, and then suddenly you're supposed to be sex vixens. Like, it doesn't work. That doesn't go real well. Male or female, it doesn't go real well. Mm-hmm. So I would say a lot of the struggles I had after I got married was more around like, how do I have boundaries with this? How do I stand up for myself? How do I get what I need in this? How do I communicate about this? Because no one ever taught me how to talk about sex. But I would say other than that first week after the honeymoon, when we got back and I was freaking out because I was pretty geographically close to where my brother lived, I don't feel like the assault had a super profound impact on how I interacted with my ex-husband.
I mean, I'm surprised by that.
Surprised by which part?
That it didn't impact you. I feel like, I mean, I haven't been through that, so I don't really know. My assumption is like, oh, you've had a really bad experience with sex. And even in the right circumstances with the right person, like, it would still be triggering, for lack of a better word. Like, it would still be scary. You're just like, okay, I've only had negative experiences with this act. And now I'm like consensually participating in this. It would still be scary to some extent.
I think it was scary to some extent. And I think that after I started PTSD treatment, there were times when I was a mess, crying, curled up in a ball. But I don't think we were having sex like the same day I had therapy. Mm-hmm. My ex was an asshole about some things, but I don't think he was an asshole about that. That I recall. And I know that there were random moments where something would trigger me. There were random moments when stuff would trigger me, but it wasn't a consistent problem that I recall. I don't recall it being a consistent problem. There were some things that my brother did to me, like specific things that were a little more traumatic and took more therapy eventually, or just time with me thinking about it or talking to a trusted girlfriend or something to sort of process it. But the other thing, because you said, oh, that surprises me. And what immediately popped into mind for me was, well, I'm a rule follower, and the rule said no sex before marriage, but in marriage, you can have sex. So it was like, okay, red is stop, you're not married, don't. Green is go, you're married, now you can. So I think because the way I'm wired, being such a lawful, good rule follower, it kind of decomplicated it a little bit for me.
That's fascinating. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but it sounds like because it was so heavily instilled in you that like no sex before marriage, but afterwards it's fair game, like go for it. Like that was stronger than the absolutely horrible negative experiences that you had with sex prior to it.
Yeah. And keep in mind, I wasn't having a great time.
Yeah.
I wasn't having a great time. So I think a lot of my work, frankly, I don't think this even happened until after my divorce, was around checking back into my own body and allowing myself to be a sexual being. We're all sexual beings. Mm-hmm. And allowing myself to accept that. And try to begin normalizing it for myself. So I would say I had less trauma work and more somatic checking back into my own being work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yes, I would say the purity culture was so ingrained in me that the rule change of, okay, now you're married, it's all fair game, was a pretty profound thing for me.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, and obviously you work in this space now.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how different that is for somebody that didn't come, that was sexually assaulted or raped or whatever, mm-hmm. but they weren't in a strict religious environment. If
okay, so this is what I find fascinating. So yes, I have had these conversations with hundreds of people over the years doing the work I do, and it's not as clear cut as that. So you'll have, let's make the focus female, because the people who have told me their stories are primarily female over the years. And something that I think is really interesting is young women who were sexually assaulted, who grew up in really like strict purity culture, Christian, Catholic standards. Yes, some of them reacted like me and completely shut down sexually and had no interest in it. And then others had what is also a very normal response to sexual assault, which is like, okay, all I'm good for is sex. And that's, they begin to identify with like this hypersexualized version of themselves. And I see that in my work, even in people who grow up in really repressive purity culture environments. So it's not really, that's the interesting thing about it. It's not really limited. You can grow up in a repressive environment and either be like, nope, never having sex ever, see you, bye. Or like, yep, that's all I'm good for, so I guess I might as well. Or, you know, my purity was taken, so what does it even matter anymore? And you see the same thing in people who don't grow up in restrictive environments. They might be like, nope, never having sex again. Or they might be like, well, what's the fucking point? Mm-hmm. You know, it's already all ruined anyways. So I hope that that's comforting if you have lived through sexual assault, to know like whichever way you reacted, or, you know, there's more than just those two, but there are myriad ways survivors react, and there's a lot of commonality no matter how you grow up. And if you were in a really religious home, there's still a ton of overlap in how survivors respond. So there's real strong community. You can absolutely find people who reacted however it is you reacted. They're out there, and you can find support and a network of people who understand what you've been through.
I guess another part of that is, how much did the checking out play a role in that? Do you think that's a reason why you were able to like have sex, like consensual sex, because you were checking out of your body? Was that a factor at all?
I think I could have sex because, at least at the beginning, I really loved my ex-husband. And I wanted to have a complete and robust life with him. And I was bound and determined that what happened to me as a child was not going to dictate how I lived as an adult. And it was more than just sex. Mm-hmm. I was determined that I would heal. I was determined that I would be okay someday. I was determined that I was going to get to the bottom of how the sexual assault had impacted my life. And I was going to heal it as far as it went. I was gonna go heal it. And so I think it was kind of that combination of, you know, I loved him and I wanted to have a complete relationship with him, and I didn't want what I went through to impact my life in my marriage and in adulthood and in my sexual relationship with my ex. So I'm not saying there weren't bumps along the way, but I had, again, I think I've talked about, you know, my unkillable belief system about a couple different things, but I had an unkillable belief that I could have a healthy sexual relationship with my significant other, and that I could get to a point where acknowledging my own sexuality was not traumatic. And I would say, honestly, the harder work was after my divorce and realizing I shared about this in the divorce episode, you know, how unsafe I felt in that marriage and how hurt I was in that marriage, and how that marriage and the sexual elements that developed were so damaging to me. I did a lot of work after the divorce to heal the trauma. Like, honestly, my ex making me watch porn was more traumatic to my sex life with him than the sexual assault ever was. My ex dragging me to strip clubs was more traumatic to my sex life with him than the sexual assault ever was. So that was my journey. Everyone's journey is going to be different. Mm-hmm. But for me, the really hard work was the somatic work that happened later.
I mean, the theme in the last, especially in the last couple episodes, is just kind of, it's really a kind of a mind over matter thing, that if you want to have a good sex life, or you want to work through something, or you want it to be whatever it is, if you want it to be better, like, that can kind of trump a lot of stuff, or at least help you get through it.
Well, I agree and I disagree, because I think anytime we use the phrase mind over matter with a trauma survivor, that's, I would call it pretty calloused. I would never, ever, 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 ever say mind over matter to a trauma survivor. I would instead say, oh, let's see. How would I phrase that? I would say, what is the life you want?
Yeah.
It's okay to not be there right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to attack you in this, Kyle. I'm trying to make sure that we frame it well, because how we frame stuff really does impact perception and how people are able to receive messaging and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's important. So I would say, yeah, maybe visualize the life you want. And maybe sex is so traumatic that the life you want isn't even having good sex. Maybe the life you want is just not being so fucking afraid of the concept of sex, or not hating the fact that humans are sexual beings. Like, you can start small. Mm-hmm. You can start real small. For me, the first step was, the life I wanted was being able to live fully present in my body and in the moment. And so, yeah, it's totally fine to start small. And then maybe from there, you work on that, you work on healing that, you make progress and you get to a good spot. And then maybe the next step is, I would love to feel safe every time I think about having sex with my significant other. And then you keep stepping it from there. And one thing I would do differently, knowing what I know now, is I never, ever, ever would have forced myself to have sex with my ex. I never would have just, you know, gritted my teeth and gotten through it. Mm-hmm. I would have had a lot more boundaries. I wish I would have, at the time, had the knowledge and courage to say what I wanted and what I needed and those things. So I think if you are a sexual assault survivor and you are in a relationship where you are having consensual sex and you're struggling and you're triggered and you're traumatized, you might need to stop for a while. You might need to stop, and you might need to do therapeutic work to just learn how to check in with yourself and be okay with being a sexual being. And then, like, your partner who loves you might need to do some work to learn how to be a more compassionate lover, a more compassionate partner. It doesn't all just have to be on you. I would say if you're getting real fucking triggered by sex, look at the whole picture. Is it just you? Is it just your trauma? Or are you in a relationship with someone who's inconsiderate, or isn't respecting your boundaries, or isn't patient with what you can and can't handle based on where you are in your healing journey? Bottom line, the whole problem might not be you.
Yeah. I mean, it takes two to tango, and And part of that is you need that other person to also be there with you wherever it is you're at so that you can keep healing and moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And then if you have a partner who's just an angel and they're patient and they're not causing you any harm, you like really do assess it and you're like, nope, this is all me. Okay, you know what? You were sexually traumatized. It's okay to have some carryover into a consensual adult relationship. You are normal. You are not weird. You are not a failure. You're not bad. You're someone who is deeply hurt because sex is so, gosh, I'm afraid to say what I want to say because I don't want it to sound like purity culture, but so I'm going to say it anyways, and then I'll explain what I mean. I believe sex is sacred. I think it's a beautiful thing. I think it's a really incredible way to connect. And I think it needs to be treated with respect. Now, that doesn't mean that I think you better only ever have sex with one person. You better be married to them and the lights better be out and it better be missionary. Like, that is not what I'm saying at all, okay? Being very clear on this. But I think that the reason sexual assault hurts so much is because it is such a sacred part of being a human. We are sexual beings, and we should have total agency over that aspect of who we are. So all that to say, you're not weird. You're not bad. If you're struggling with even consensual sex post sexual assault. So again, I am a one string banjo. I really suggest therapy. and specifically maybe consider working with someone who specializes in somatic healing, somatic work. Rosen therapy was really effective for me, not even just sexually, but just as a person checking back into my body and not numbing out, you know, the fact that I'm a person, I'm in a body. Rosen therapy was super effective. I love it, but it's hard to find actual Rosen certified practitioners. So you can look up, I think it's called the Rosen Institute. I think they're in California. I forget, but you can find their website and try to find a practitioner near you. I ended up traveling. I traveled an hour and a half one way to a practitioner, and it was worth the time. It was worth the money. Because again, not even just as a sexual being, but as a person being able to be fully present in my body is something that Rosen therapy helped me with. And it actually helped me address a bunch of pain and, you know, all this other stuff. So there are a lot of benefits beyond human sexuality to learning how to find safety, checking back into your own body. So I would say maybe consider that. I would say consider having some really honest conversations with your partner. If they are doing things that are triggering for you, if they have habits, if you've talked to them about this stuff and gosh, they're still doing it or they're still asking you to do it, there might be whole quadrants of sexual expression that just need to be off limits for a while you heal and while you figure stuff out. And that is okay. And you are allowed to have that boundary. I wish someone had been there to say that to me when I was 22.
So there's a couple things you touched on that I want to circle back to a little bit. One, there's been a recurring theme with distance from the cult or just like harmful people. Mm-hmm. Like the physical distance seems to be
it's a game changer. And physical and emotional distance.
Yeah. And then I guess the second kind of related question to that is, in the cult, and specifically as a female in the cult, do you think dissociating from your body is that a normal part of being a female in the cult? Or
Because your body is bad.
Okay.
Your body is a trap. Your body is a lure for men. Your body betrays you. Your body is the reason you got sexually assaulted. Because again, hyper-religious environments have an improper understanding of what causes sexual assault. They're always going to say it's sex and lust, which is absolute bullshit. Sexual assault is caused by malicious power and control dynamics. So your body is not the problem. Your body was never the problem. Your body is good. That's another thing I wish someone had told me a really, really, really long time ago. Your body is good. What happened to you is not your body's fault. Huh. If you remember nothing else from this episode, remember that your body is good. And it was not your body's fault. So yeah, to answer your question, I do think that checking out of your body, even without sexual assault, is very common for particularly women who grew up in cults and repressive environments, because you're taught from a young age that your body's bad. Yeah. Until you get married. Then you have to be a sex vixen, or, you know, whatever you want to call it.
You got to be available all the time.
And you got to be available.
So you got to go from being never available and don't even, like, even remotely, you know,
blink. Don't even know your own anatomy to. Yeah,
don't know your anatomy and don't blink at a man because it may be too, insinuating you want sex. Mm-hmm. To going to the complete opposite end of the spectrum and just being like, all right, now everything's
now your whole purpose is to be available for him sexually.
I don't see a world in which that ever ends well. Like,
I would love to flip that script. Kyle, it is your entire job to be available for me sexually constantly. I mean, you kind of already are. But, you know. I don't know how that would work if as a society we were like, women have all the sexual power.
Well, I think in some circles, depending on your
well, yeah, I guess the non-cult men probably would say women have all the sexual power.
I'm just being in fetish ways. There's circles in which that is normal.
Well, there is that too.
But getting back to the physical distance thing, and I know this is kind of a little off topic, but why do you think it's so, like, powerful that getting away from the cult was so helpful for you to, like, kind of disentangle process all that and process it, and then, like, being close to the cult or where the person that was sexually assaulting you had such a profound impact?
I think it's access in a lot of ways. At the time, I was still required by the family to act like everything was fine and he was my brother and everything was great. So, I mean, there's fear that he'd stop by our place, that I'd see him at the grocery store. So when you have physical distance, statistically, it cuts down the possibility that you're going to open your front door and see that person standing there, or, you know, find yourself in line with them at the grocery store. So I think that physical distance just removes a lot of variables and unknowns. I stopped allowing my family to have my address after I moved away. It just felt safer. I knew I wasn't going to open my door and see them there. So yeah, I know that that's not an option for everyone, just like pick up and move across the country to get away from harmful people in your life. But if that is an option that you have, I found it to be a very powerful factor in my healing.
It's sad that that's it seems like that's such a good way to take a step in the right direction. It's also such a hard thing to do.
Yeah. And I mean, it's another thing where it's like incumbent upon the victim to move themselves across the country to get away from harm, which again, you know, so frustrating.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, that was powerful. It really was.
And going back to another thing you said earlier, and specifically, some of the listeners have mentioned this before of around triggers, but I also know that you've kind of reframed that, or one of your therapists reframed that for you into...
Oh, remnants.
Remnants.
Yeah. Okay. So a trigger is going to be like a full-on trauma, like it's a trauma situation. And after I went through intensive therapy for PTSD and I no longer met the criteria from PTSD and I had made what is considered a full recovery, my really amazing psychologist at the time told me like, all right, hey, you're still going to have stuff that pops up from time to time and it's going to trouble you. Trigger wasn't a word that was being used at that time. Cause again, this was a very long time ago, but, in today's lingo, what he said was things will trigger you. And he told me, don't freak out. It doesn't mean you're regressing. Doesn't mean the trauma is all coming back. That's a normal part of being a person who's lived through some hard stuff and they'll become fewer with time and they'll become less intense with time. And I think the fact that he set me up for success with that, because like you said, he framed it so well for me. And he called them remnants. I have had remnants. But just like he said, they have become fewer and fewer and fewer with time, and they're nowhere near the intensity level that they used to be. You know, a remnant used to be like, okay, this is a big bad moment. Okay. And maybe it lasted a couple hours, maybe it lasted a day. Maybe I was like kind of dysregulated for a couple days. These days, it's like if something triggers me, it's a blip. I mean, you've seen that happen. How long would you say it lasts? Like a couple minutes?
Yeah, usually. And you're able to vocalize it. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I could see it on your face, but you can also vocalize it. And you're just like, I'm having a bad memory.
Mm-hmm. And it's not even sex. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it'll happen if I see a movie or just like sometimes I'll smell something that reminds me of.
I've heard that's like the most.
Yeah, olfactory is mm-hmm. a real big one. So I will have different moments throughout my life where something will, you know, just take me back to a moment in my childhood. And at this point, I'm so confident that it's going to end soon and I'll be back to normal that it's not a big disruption to my life. And, you know, I used to have remnants pretty frequently, like multiple a month or something. And now I would say it's like annually, a couple times a year, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't shut down my day or my life. I'm able to, you know, continue with whatever I was doing, which again is why it's so important to get appropriate care and support, because it is possible to reach a place where you're not constantly re-traumatized. And to offer some hope for folks who are struggling, like Kyle, I would say what we have like a 12 out of 10 sex life.
Yes, I would rate it that way.
Yeah, like you can get to a place where you have an absolutely fantastic sex life. Yeah, I'm very, very happy with that category of my life. And so to again, like the big sister I wish I had, although I don't know if I'd want my sister to talk to me about sex. How about the friend? The friend I wish I had when I was younger. I do want to tell you, it is possible to get to a place where you're healed enough that your consensual sex life is a really happy, thriving part of who you are.
One of the hard parts of doing this podcast is just the heartbreaking messages that some people send us. Mm-hmm. But also one of the best parts of it is that people will send these messages of like how much hearing your story helps them just to have someone else say it out loud, which you've mentioned before, like when you got to college, you're like, oh, like someone's saying this. Mm-hmm. So it's also like one of the best parts. And so I'm sure I speak for all of those listeners when I say like, thanks for being open and sharing these things, even though it's I'm sure hard. But hopefully that was helpful to those listeners that have went through those things or grew up in the cult, and have those remnants mm-hmm. or still are battling some of those mm-hmm. memories and scared of whatever it is just because mm-hmm. of their, you know, the previous experiences. So yeah, thanks for being open and honest about that. And, you know, sex is a little bit of a taboo subject, even outside of the cult. Mm-hmm. So hopefully everybody got something out of that and know that there's, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel there and it's achievable.
And I'll say, you know, one other thing I've heard a lot, not just from listeners, but in a lot of years of interacting with survivors is folks who say, like, I hate that my trauma is impacting my partner mm-hmm. because they didn't hurt me. This isn't their fault. And I feel so bad about it. And I'll go back to take a really good, honest look at, you know, are you really the only problem? Are you being triggered because the other person isn't being patient or kind enough or respecting your boundaries? And if the answer to that is nope, they're being awesome, then I would encourage you to lean into the love that's there. You know, that person is with you for a reason. They love you for a reason. And especially if it's a marriage partner, we didn't sign up for perfect all the time. We signed up to learn and grow. And if you and your partner can communicate about this, if you can be honest, like put it on the table between you, like, yep, this is a part of our marriage that's struggling. It's a part of our relationships that's struggling. This is not where we want it to be. I feel like I'm hurting you because of my trauma. That isn't your fault. What I've found is that the more you can name it, the more you can talk about it, the more you can make it something you're working on together, the faster you're probably going to heal. And well, let me say it this way. It's going to be real, real, real hard to heal if you're like, okay, I got to do this and I got to do this fast because I don't want to hurt my partner and I really love my partner. My partner's a great person and this isn't their fault. And I need to heal this yesterday. Like that's so much stress and that is so much pressure. And that's probably not going to help you get where you want to be. So if you guys can together acknowledge the issue fully, and maybe have some grief, like grieve it together too. Cause I know a lot of people who've shared their story with me, they do have some intense grief around like, I know this is supposed to be good and I'm ruining it for the other person. Acknowledge that together. And then maybe your partner needs some support. Maybe there's some therapeutic work they can do so that they have, you know, that confidentiality with a trusted ally, a trusted resource who can help them love you well through the healing and can help them support you and can be a place where they can vent, where they can talk about, you know, maybe. And this might hurt a little, but maybe the truth that it is really hard, you know, to not have the sex life they want at that time. But if you guys can name it together, if you can seek individual support and bring the healing back together in a very peaceful, calm, measured way, again, stress is not going to help. Freaking out about this and feeling bad about it is not going to help you heal. So yeah, I would say definitely consider getting individual support. It's probably a really good idea if you're still going through long-term healing for sexual assault. You know, the sexual dysfunction or the sexual issues in your relationship aren't just, you know, going to disappear overnight. You're not going to magically heal and be fine tomorrow. So have a plan, have an honest, open conversation around planning. All right, what are we going to do? How are we going to connect? How are we going to find intimacy through this long road of healing? But always remember that healing is possible and you can get to a place where you are comfortable in your own body and you're comfortable in your own sexuality and you enjoy your sexual relationship with your partner.
Well, thanks for running through all of that. I know we're in a a weird spot here where this is all cult adjacent. And unfortunately, you know, the amount of messages we've received from listeners, like there are a lot of people dealing with this type of stuff. So I think it's still relevant to talk to and hopefully help people, you know, the people that are in your position or similar positions or come from those backgrounds. And hopefully that's still helpful, useful information for, you know, people like me that didn't come from those backgrounds and didn't have those experiences, but it, maybe you're with somebody like Amanda and now, you know. So yeah, I hope that was a helpful episode for anybody listening, and we'll be back next Monday.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Cult I Left Behind.
Until next time, don't join a cult.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please like, share, and subscribe, and we will catch you on the next episode.